this week. Gold, silver, stocks, bonds, even the U.S. dollar rallied. Welcome back to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Chris Walczak here. It's great to be with you. We've got another mega guest-packed episode, including a must-hear discussion with two top precious metals insiders. First up, CEO of Brazil Resources, BRI.V, Amir Adnani, makes his show debut. He has a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. And a top investment fund owns 17% of BRI's shares, Sprott Asset Management. He's partnered with legendary investor Mario Garneiro of Brazil Invest. Then Nick Barashev of Bullion Gold Management has gold price targets that will make every single listener, no matter how bullish, happy you listened. He thinks stocks are overpriced like many of my recent guests. Gold could climb 750%, even $10,000 an ounce. And if that sounds too fantastic to believe, he thinks it's now an understatement. He's writing a new book explaining why his first forecast was so lowball. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. We'd like for you to call into our toll-free hotline. We'll be setting up another Q&A episode as soon as next week. 1-206-6665-370. You can just jot it down on a post-it pad, put it next to the phone, or program it right into your phone or iPhone. 1-206-6665-370. GoldSeek.com radio begins with the market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the New York COMEX exchange as investors worldwide turned to the gold safe haven amid a global stock market meltdown. Gold added about $7 for the week, shy of 1%, finishing at $10.96 an ounce. Silver picked up 15 cents, 1%, finishing over the $14 level, while the XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index picked up a quarter point, ending at 41, and West Texas Intermediate crude up a point and a half, 5%, finishing at $32 per barrel. Well, the top story driving the precious metals sector was continued global equities market volatility. Gold and silver benefited as safe haven purchases poured in earlier in the week. The U.S. stock market retested last year's August lows, plus housing starts were much lower than anticipated, according to government statistics on Wednesday, further increasing investors' appetite for the yellow metal. In related news, the FOMC meets next week, culminating with its latest benchmark rate decision. The current Fed Funds futures contracts indicate only a 12% likelihood that policymakers will take rates from the 0.5% to 0.75% level. So no rate hike most likely next week. Only slightly higher odds for the March meeting. Nevertheless, odds strongly favor at least one or even two more quarter point rate hikes this year that should culminate with 1% or higher in the overnight lending rate by year end. Higher rates are viewed as dollar supportive. Nevertheless, one media source noted that increased gold demand could be the result of China's lunar celebrations where gold gifts are highly favored. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, despite the solid week, the U.S. dollar is still poised, I think, for new multi-year records, which could subdue any commodities rally in the midterm. However, we have to point out Citigroup raised its 2016 forecast for gold by 7.5% up to 1,070 on Tuesday, and that improves the investment outlook. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange following a 4% rally in the energy sector shares, which rebounded from last week's 12-year low in the crude oil market. The Dow finished at 1693, up over 100, just shy of it for the week, while the S&P added 27, up almost 1.5%, and the NASDAQ picked up 2%, 103 points, flying back to 45.91. Short sellers chose the sidelines ahead of next week's big rate decision after retesting last autumn's sell-off support. Still, the Dow never fell below that nadir, indicating some internal signs of strength, thanks in no small part to the energy sector rally. The rebound followed West Texas Intermediate crude, which blasted higher, as I said, by 5%. Bottom line on Wall Street, little changed since last week. Technically, our 7-component sentiment index remains in extremely fearful territory, indicating that the market is likely at or near the oversold level. Plus, the CBOT VIX and VVIX indexes finally gave us a reversal signal, a big positive, with the Dow successfully testing support. Although it's a bit early to call a bottom, signs are starting to indicate a bounce is likely. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio with Nick Barishev from Bullion Management Group and CEO of Brazil Resources, Amir Adnani. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome founder and chairman of Brazil Resources, Amir Adnani. Fortune magazine lists Mr. Adnani on the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch North American executives. Welcome, Amir Adnani.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I wonder if you would like to share with our listening audience just an overview of your professional background, followed by maybe a bullet list of what compelled you to develop Brazil Resources.
I'd be happy to do that. So, you know, for me, I'm based in Vancouver, Canada. I graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree from University of British Columbia. I'm still very involved with my alma mater. I serve on the board of directors of the Alumni Association for UBC. Been involved in the junior resource space primarily as an entrepreneur and in the uranium and gold space. In the uranium space, I've been acting as the CEO and founder of Uranium Energy Corp since 2005, so basically a decade of building that company. But what we're really kind of, in my mind, proud of in developing Uranium Energy Corp was the fact that really in 2005 we started with a business plan. And by 2010, in 5 years, we had achieved initial production. And as you can appreciate in the resource business, for a company to move that quickly from concept to production in 5 years, that says a lot about execution and the ability to organize both the geologic resources, financial resources, and human resources to get to that point. And I think as a result of that, today we can see that Uranium Energy Corp, as a U.S. company focused on low-cost in-situ recovery production, listed on the NYSE MKT market, really is one of a handful of independent, publicly listed uranium producers out there. And we're quite pleased with that, and we have still quite a bit of work ahead of us. With Brazil Resources, much of the same formula and recipe that had worked so well for Uranium Energy Corp is what we wanted to apply here, in the sense that it always starts with exceptional people, people that have a strong vested interest, can go out there and focus on a business plan and execute on that business plan. And with Brazil Resources, really from day one, it was about identifying projects in areas in northern Brazil and Pará State and Maranhão State that had been subject to a great deal of historic artisanal mining production, or what they call garimpo production in Brazil, and in the last decade, more of a modern and advanced stage type of exploration is being applied to these greenstone gold belts in northern Brazil to identify projects that have considerable potential. And so for us, it was about coming into Brazil, looking at a very specific business model, and looking to make acquisitions at a time when frankly, is a really exceptional time to be making acquisitions the last 2 to 3 years with this downturn that we've had in the mining sector.
Firstly, thank you for that overview. It's refreshing to hear that you use the term your search for exceptional people, because I think it's easy for investors, there's maybe even a tendency to look at the numbers and to look at the projects and forget that it really is the human capital, the intellectual capital behind the projects that makes it a success. So hat tip for that. Well, you've clearly assembled a notable management team. Maybe that's a good segue into the next question. This includes Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil's foremost merchant and investment bank, and that's Brazil Invest.
Yeah, for sure. So again, not to be confused with the name of the company. So while our company is called Brazil Resources, one of our founding shareholders and founding directors is the oldest and one of the most successful investment banks and investment groups in Brazil, called Brazil Invest. And Brazil Invest is based out of Sao Paulo. Throughout their history, they've attracted and executed close to 16 billion dollars in investments. The founder and head of the group, Mario Garnero, who is one of our founding directors and serves on our board of directors, is one of the best-known businessmen and entrepreneurs in that country. And so this really for a junior gold company, being Brazil Resources, to have such a strong and formidable strategic partner and founder involved that can not only be a source of local deal flow in Brazil, a source of local sponsorship, but also a very strong source of financial and financing capability, really covers a lot of bases in one partner. And they've been, again, a very meaningful partner since day one, continue to invest in the company and the various financing rounds that we've completed in the last couple of years. I think any resource company, really, at the end of the day, given that we operate in different jurisdictions, sometimes you can say any company is as good as the technical merits of the project, but at the same time, you're as good as the people and the local partners and sponsors that you have in any jurisdiction. So we really feel that it's been a great vote of confidence for the company that such a group has become involved and has been involved since day one, and I'm referring to Brazil Invest. And it really doesn't stop there. When you kind of look at some of the other members of our board or technical team, for example, we have on our board of directors Herb Dhaliwal, who was Canada's Minister of Mines and Energy, a very, again, notable individual there in Herb and his involvement. Some of the technical people involved, including the senior management, Garnet Dawson, our CEO, Paulo Pereira, who's based in Brazil, our president. Between Garnet and Paulo, there's over 60 years, almost 70 years of experience working with majors and juniors in the mining business. In various commodities, of course, precious metals and also in base metals. And so, again, without going into too many resumes and CVs here, it really goes back to the people factor and the diversification of skill sets, right, where we're not just talking about people that have only explored for gold or only mined gold, but really you can see in our team here a combination of entrepreneurship coupled with very strong financing capabilities and background, coupled with strong exploration and development experience, coupled with political experience, and all of that combined with a very strong equity interest and vested interest in the company, where we're very much aligned with our shareholders. Collectively, the board, including myself, including Mario Garnero, we own close to 25% of the company and have invested very meaningfully in the company in our various financing rounds. And that's the key takeaway from me. I mean, you could have the best people and the best resumes, but there's going to be a disconnect if the alignment is not there with equity holders. And that is something here that you can see with BRI. We really connect all these dots.
You know, I appreciate the concept you bring up of diversification of qualifications, interests, and backgrounds. Just brought to mind briefly an anecdote from history where one of the original explorers in South America came across a huge mine of silver, but the silver vein ran out. But they knew that there was a tremendous amount of silver left in this mountain. In fact, it was the largest ever found to this date. They just couldn't, using the methodologies in Europe at the time, the Spanish explorer couldn't figure out how to extract the ore. But because of his background in science over a period of several months, he realized by adding a few chemicals, I think it was copper sulfate, very easily extract, that led to a massive sea change in economics around the world. That's why I just think that your idea of diversification of backgrounds can lead to such synergies on a forward basis for Brazil Resources. Let's talk about Brazil. What an interesting country. It's a BRICS nation, the eighth largest economy in the world, where officials have nurtured and fostered a mining-friendly reputation. Are there any additional benefits that investors would like to hear regarding the operations in Brazil?
I think it's important that we highlight how some of the developments in Brazil are important for also our strategy and how we're really set up to tackle this. So when you think about what we just covered in the previous question with respect to Brazil Invest and their strategic involvement with our company. Clearly, we feel that in Brazil, we have the right local partner to find opportunities and to be able to advance projects. And so that's an important part of why we have put our initial focus on this country. Secondly, we were able to successfully really look at areas in northern Brazil, and in particular in Pará State in northern Brazil, where there's almost a 200-year history of artisanal gold mining, and where this gold mining has led to a number of new discoveries where companies have come in and drilled deeper into shallow targets that have been produced by artisanal miners, or gold had been produced from by these groups. And when you drill targets that have had this shallow mineralization, you find some deeper sources of gold and mineralization that then helps develop the resources that we're interested in. So we feel that for the purposes of having a strategy like ours, which is to acquire gold projects and gold resources, ounces of gold in the ground that have been defined through previous drilling and exploration, that it's great to be in an environment where a lot of work has been done, a lot of history exists, and so we can acquire these projects during the current downturn, which goes back to the core strategy. So when you think about our strategy being that we want to be acquiring gold ounces in the ground during the current downturn, because it's much cheaper to buy an ounce of gold in the ground right now than to take on exploration risk and drill for it, then Brazil is a very good place for that, given the history and given the work that has been done there in the last couple of decades, and even before that, over the last century, with the artisanal miners. Secondly, we've got our strategic partner in Brazil Invest that can really give us that local support and sponsorship to find the right opportunities. And then we find ourselves in the last 6 to 12 months with the currency advantage in Brazil, where the Brazilian real, the local currency, has really been suffering. It's now near an all-time low to the U.S. dollar. And this relationship is, in fact, makes it more affordable to do business there, whether it's acquisitions, exploration, or if you're a producer of gold in Brazil, that currency advantage actually adds up to be another form of margin that it's difficult to get right now with the fall in the price of gold. It's great to be able to pick margin back up when you have the currency fluctuation going in your favor. And that's definitely one of the advantages in Brazil right now.
Two of your key mines are located in northern Brazil. One project includes paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source of electricity and water. Many other key features. Please tell the listening audience more.
Yes, we're talking first about our São Jorge project in Pará State. Again, I want to emphasize the fact that, as we can all appreciate, Brazil is a big country. And so for a company, you need to have focus. You need to look at specific areas you're going to come in. And that's what we've done. We're not all over Brazil. We've taken a very specific focus on, again, northern Brazil in one particular state. In Brazil, a lot of permitting for exploration and future development production, this permitting happens primarily at the state level. So it's important to have some of those synergies and areas of focus. And so within Pará State, we've acquired four different gold projects. The flagship project, São Jorge, is located in what is one of the largest alluvial gold regions in Brazil. In fact, kind of top five in the world. It is an area where there's a nearby operating mine. Companies, majors like Eldorado, have acquired development stage projects in this area. And we're quite happy with the work that has been done here historically. There's been drilling done before we arrived at the scene. There's been close to 37,000 meters of diamond drilling completed. That's about 145 holes. But yet, that's only explored 10% of the property. 90% is unexplored, and that's because it's a 55,000-hectare property, so it's fairly large. It's only 70 kilometers away from a town of Novo Progresso, where there's population about 60,000 people. This is a mining-friendly town where a lot of the local workforce or skilled labor you would need would be coming from this town. As you mentioned, we're near a paved highway with access to water and fairly inexpensive hydroelectric power that's available, and even an existing power line that comes to site. These are really great features on a resource where we have an indicated mineral resource of 715,000 ounces of gold at 1.54 gram per ton, and an inferred resource of just over 1 million ounces of gold at 1.14 gram per ton. Really want to emphasize that the work done and what we're talking about here is something that we were able to acquire for cents on the dollar, and it's really what is attractive to me about both the current market downturn and the business strategy that we have to be making these acquisitions. Projects like this that you can buy near infrastructure, near another producing mine, in an area where you've had historically some of the largest alluvial gold mining in the world, and you can buy it basically during this downturn at a fraction of what these projects were trading at or being valued at in the marketplace just four years ago. That's not that long back.
Another key property located in northern Brazil, Cachoeira, benefits from a solid infrastructure, close proximity to a highway. Now, this property includes three deposits with near-surface mineralization, and that's if I read the literature right. How might this property boost Brazil Resources' profitability?
So really, again, this is another resource stage project. As you mentioned, there's been involvement by a number of different companies here. Bigger companies like Noranda, Goldfields, Kinross have been involved in this area. Historically, it was really three distinct projects, and that's the attractive thing here, that under this new consolidated ownership, we control the three different resource areas that are situated south and north of yet another highway that runs really right through this area, which, again, adds to that infrastructure advantage that we were talking about. Again, we see with this project a good indicated mineral resource of just under 700,000 ounces of gold at 1.2 gram per ton, an inferred mineral resource of 530,000 ounces at 1.07 gram per ton. This kind of grade and resource should be sufficient and should be, let's say, a workable resource in the future as we do more work to determine the potential of these projects for open pit mining. These are quite acceptable grades for that development or that type of development. And also, again, the fact that it's near infrastructure, the fact that it's so accessible by road, really adds to the future potential viability of these projects. So, again, you can see that the fact that we're concentrating on projects with similar style of mineralization, similar grade, similar potential for future development in terms of the open pit mining method, near infrastructure, all in one state within Brazil, where you're going to have those future synergies from a permitting point of view. You can hopefully appreciate it, and your listeners can appreciate the thoughtfulness and strategy that we've put into our execution within Brazil with assembling the portfolio in that country within that particular state.
Top gold stock analyst Peter Spina was so interested by Brazil Resources' diversification among your portfolio of properties. And you have a uranium ore property in Alaska with a unique benefit of $10 million in previous exploration by major firms in the industry. And that's such an interesting opportunity because it's a treasure map left over by other explorers. In addition, you have the geological strata there with many key similarities to other uranium discoveries in the area. Would you like to add any further details about this interesting uranium property?
It was really a great deal of serendipity with how this project came into our fold. And as part of an acquisition that we did of a company back in 2013 with gold assets in Brazil, that company had this uranium project in their portfolio, and they had acquired this project back in 2005. When uranium prices were at probably around $12 a pound and before we had the bull market of uranium in 06 and 07. So they were quite ahead of the curve. They had acquired this project at a time where no one was really paying attention to Western Athabasca Basin. So Athabasca Basin is a region of Canada and Saskatchewan where some of the highest grade operating uranium mines are situated. And historically, everyone's focused on Eastern Athabasca Basin, but Western Athabasca Basin in the last few years has become a hot spot for exploration. A couple of companies there that have had super success. There's almost $400 million of combined market cap now in Western Athabasca Basin just on exploration. And you can appreciate that's not bad given how difficult the resource markets are now. But the property that we own was acquired in 05, and again, well ahead of the curve. And so as a result, it's a very good size project at 88,000 hectares. We have a relationship there with Areva, which is a major French nuclear company. They actually own 25% of the property. And this is mainly due to the fact that the property completely surrounds one of Areva's important exploration projects called Mabel River. So it's also, you know, always an advantageous position when you can be benefiting from a strong land position that surrounds a major's exploration project. Makes you a bit more important to that major. And $10 million of exploration work done on our property also shows some very important geophysical and structural features that have been identified on our project, similar to those that are associated with the other two successful exploration projects that we've seen in Western Athabasca Basin. So this is a situation where we have a drill-ready project. We have our drill permit in hand. You have the vote of confidence, which is the involvement of Areva, a major company that owns 25% of our property. You have the fact that we surround their important exploration project, Mabel River, entirely. And this is all happening at a time where, of all commodities, uranium has actually been one that has performed much better year-to-date and year-over-year. Uranium prices are, in fact, up year-over-year, where during the same period we've seen this really fell off in oil and some of the other commodities. Uranium has really bucked the trend and gone the other way. And this definitely provides a nice, again, going back to diversification, provides a very nice diversification and a hedge almost for our shareholder base, that while we're sitting on a very attractive gold portfolio, and that has been our focus since day one, since 2011 when the company got up and running, we've been focusing on acquiring a quality gold portfolio, which we now have, and we're building on that, and we're acquiring more gold projects. But this uranium optionality, which has come into the fold with, you know, again, a bit of luck and a bit of good timing, and, you know, sometimes you need to get lucky as well in this business, this works out really well. And, of course, with my background and experience in the uranium business as the founder and CEO of Uranium Energy that we talked about at the beginning of this interview, we certainly have the necessary skill sets to be able to give that benefit to our shareholders in Brazil Resources to help advance this property. Perhaps at some point we'll monetize it, maybe spin it out into a new vehicle. That would also help create additional value, most likely for our shareholders, and create a more focused exposure that way.
Well, you've covered so much about the Brazil area, but you also have an interesting property recently acquired in Alaska. I wonder if you could tell us more about the Whistler property.
Well, as we've discussed, of course, the company started out with a very particular focus in Brazil for all the reasons we discussed. The overarching strategy, though, as we've also discussed, has been to look at acquiring projects with resources, and we're talking about 43-101 resources in the ground. Look at doing this, especially now during a year like this where we're seeing tremendous selling pressure on valuations across both the junior and major universe. This is really the ideal environment for a company that has a strategy to accumulate and consolidate quality projects to go shopping. I mean, you want to go shopping when everything is for sale and the sales keep getting, you know, bigger and better. And so we really feel that our overarching strategy of taking advantage of these downturns really requires us to look for opportunities beyond just Brazil. Part of that is because there are other mining-friendly jurisdictions that we're very comfortable with. Of course, the U.S. is one that we're very comfortable with. I've spent the last 10 years building Uranium Energy Corp in the U.S., we are very comfortable with Canada. We already have our uranium project in Canada. Speaking of U.S., we felt looking at Alaska that there were some large projects there. It's a very good mining-friendly state with six or seven producing mines already, some very large development stage projects. And this Whistler opportunity that was available at the Whistler Project in Alaska was something that really came at the right valuation. We acquired the project for roughly $1.6 million in stock in our company. The dilution effect was under 4%. But in return, when you look at quality of the project and what we acquired, it's a 170 square kilometer project. So this is really a district scale project. It hosts several styles of mineralization, but mainly copper gold porphyry, which is the main target on the project. And the resources in total, in terms of our indicated resources on a gold equivalent basis, there's 2.25 million ounces of gold there at a gold equivalent grade of 0.88 gram per ton, and an inferred gold equivalent resource of 3.35 million ounces at a gold equivalent grade of 0.73 gram per ton. So these are the types of deals that you can really just do in downturns like this, where you can pick up a project like this that has had almost 80,000 meters of drilling. Now, you think about what it costs to drill. And, 80,000 meters of drilling probably would cost $30 million or more to do, not to mention exploration risk that you take when you're drilling that much. But to be able to pick all of that up without any exploration risk for less than $2 million in paper with very almost insignificant dilution to your existing shareholders, that is very accretive. And I think that speaks and really helps demonstrate why we think our business strategy of acquiring this kind of optionality in the form of gold resources in the ground is really the best way to create long-term wealth for our shareholders.
As this discussion wraps up, do you have any key takeaway points for the listening audience?
I would say that we're in one of the most difficult resource environments or resource market environments of the last 10 years. There's quite a bit of pain out there in everyone's portfolios and investments. But I also really believe that this is an incredible opportunity, and an incredible opportunity for a company that has a business strategy and an ability to acquire and consolidate projects, proven projects with resources, do it at this stage of the cycle. In a downturn, opportunities that present themselves are opportunities to, again, be able to make accretive acquisitions. And I think you look at a company like Brazil Resources, we now demonstrate in the last few years through the acquisitions that we've made that we have the backers that are behind the company that help, that are really enabling us to go out there and make these acquisitions, the management team that has been successful in identifying and executing on acquisitions, growing our gold in the ground resource base between our projects in Brazil and the project in Alaska. We've seen some very strong support from shareholders. You look at the KCR Fund, which is our one of our largest shareholders. I think they own 17% of the company, which is a fund co-managed by legendary investor Rick Rule and Marin Katusa, who's a money manager and also New York Times best-selling author. You look at the people that are involved, the funds that are involved. You look at the Brazil Invest Group. You look at the institutional holders we have on our registry, like Tocqueville, which is one of the top gold funds in North America. This, to me, really demonstrates that as a key takeaway that even in a downturn, a quality strategy that is unique and not too many other companies are embarking on, like ours, attracts the right investors, attracts institutional investors, and can lead to better share price performance and stronger performance. Ultimately, I think there are, I'm Canadian, and we have recently a new Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who was elected, and he famously talks about how there are sunny days ahead. And I would say that in the resource business, it's the same. There are sunny days ahead, but we need these moments and these downturns in the market to be able to take advantage of, and we're certainly doing that and creating a lot of value for our shareholders in the process.
Well, that's music to the ears of every investor and shareholder. So I hope that listeners will take that information and recognize the value and the depth of knowledge that has been laid out here, too. Plus, note the enthusiasm of our guest today and recognize that this could be a true nugget, if you will, sitting in the stream that every investor can just pick up and add to their portfolio. To find out more about Brazil Resources, listeners are encouraged to direct their web browsers to Brazil Resources, that's all one word, BrazilResources.com. In addition, Yahoo Finance offers updates on Brazil Resources stock price, and we'll have that available for you, but BRI.V for North American investors, BRI.V, and you can find that as well at stockcharts.com. If you'd like to look at the chart that I'm looking at here, and what an impressive company. Amir Adnani, thanks so much for spending your valuable time highlighting the exciting investment opportunity at Brazil Resources.
Thank you for having me, and look forward to future opportunities to speak with you and to reach out to your audience again.
A pleasure to welcome Nick Barashev back to the show, President CEO of Bullion Management Group, BMG, widely recognized as an international bullion expert and written extensively on the topic, not to mention $10,000 gold. That's music to aficionados' ears, convinced, as are many of our guests, the yellow metal is undervalued. Welcome back, Nick Barashev.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back.
Talking before the show about some of the more interesting speeches and things that you've been working on lately, and you spoke before the Empire Club. Tell us more, please.
Well, yeah, it's an annual event that I've spoken at seven times in the past, and it's to do with market outlook for the year held in the first week of January. So this year's theme, the title is called A Tactical Opportunity, Sell High, Buy Low, which is sort of play on words from buy low, sell high. But the main point is that there's an opportunity now. Many people have been invested in the financial markets, particularly U.S. equities, and that they've done well since the bottom in 2008. But that, you know, in my view, that's now over. We're peaking, and all the indicators, without getting into all the economic factors driving this, if we just look at the results. And one of them, there's three major indicators that I cited in my speech, which is the Buffett indicator, the Shiller PE, and the Tobin Q ratio. Now, those look at whether stocks are overvalued or undervalued and so on. Now, the Buffett one takes the Dow, the entire U.S. market cap, divided by the U.S. GDP. And whenever it goes over 100, that means stocks are overvalued, and below, they're undervalued. So when we look at the previous peaks, it was 153 in 2000 and 106 in 2007. So today we have it sitting at 123. So in each case, we've had a crash following the overvaluations over the 100, and in both cases over 50%. Shiller price earnings ratio is the other indicator. It's a very long term indicator. And on that, you look at it was 32 in 1929. It was 44 in 1999, and 27 in the 2007 period. So it's now 25, where the average is 16.7. So this is indicating like 55% overvalued. And again, we're looking at a 50% correction to get it back to the average. Now, the Tobin Q ratio measures market value versus replacement cost. And the norm is about 0.7. And we had 1.6 in 2000, 0.9 in 2007. And now again, we've got 1.1, which is 58% overvalued. So forgetting about what's causing this and all in terms of all the economic indicators, it's clear that when you look at these main measurements, that stock prices in the U.S. are at least 50% overvalued, and that's how much the crash would be. Now, typically, when markets crash, they overshoot the average, so you're likely to see below that. So my point in this was now is the opportunity to sell high and take, redistribute the profits and buy low. And gold is what we have as highly undervalued right now and poised to increase dramatically. I think we formed a bottom. We've been hovering in these numbers for quite some time now, and things are starting to move. The main thing I looked at, which people forget because the sentiment is very low in gold, there's been a media barrage of you know, negative articles, gold's going to $500, all this kind of thing. But the same thing happened in the 1970s, and one of my advantages, I was old enough to actually remember the 1970s. And in 1970, gold went from $35 an ounce in 1971 to $200 by 1974. Then it corrected 45% to $100. And that's when most investors threw the towel. I'd never want to hear about gold. I don't never invest in it again. It's never going anywhere. The media was full of negative articles. And then from that low in 1976, it went up 750% in about 3 years. And I think about the same thing is going to happen now.
But, you know, there is some precedent, I think, recent precedent for just such an ascent. For instance, we watched silver in 2010 advance from roughly $14 to about 50 an ounce in just 9 months' time. Keep in mind, that's not a monetary play there. Silver is rarely viewed, although many of us disagree with that standpoint. Gold is typically viewed as the de facto alternative reserve currency. Should we see any type of currency dislocation, as many people are calling for, the IMF now accepting the yuan in its basket of global reserve currencies? I mean, this is a sea change event.
The actual implications of that haven't happened yet. They've approved the yuan for inclusion in the basket, and the current allocation is at a 10.9% ratio. But the implementation of it only starts in September. Now, the thinking is that when there's a very complicated formula that calculates what the percentage allocation that each country's currency has in the SDR. And one of the factors is gold reserves. Now, China is not accepting an allocation as low as 10.9%. They're the second largest economy in the world, so 10.9% doesn't make sense as an SDR allocation. Now, the thing is, China has been accumulating gold, and many people have looked at that and believe that the amounts that they've actually accumulated is in excess of 5,000 tons, where they're only reporting a bit over 1,000 tons. So before the implementation of the yuan in the fall, they're likely to announce their true gold holdings, and the true gold holdings are currently being held in the sovereign wealth fund, which doesn't report to anybody. So the gold is going to get transferred from the sovereign wealth fund to the central bank, and then they're going to look for an adjustment in the SDR to a higher than a 10.9% allocation. When that happens, the problem becomes, well, not a problem, but the questions that become is, where did China get their 5,000 tons? Because according to all the reporting services, GFMS and CPM, everything's being accounted for. So where did that 5,000 tons come from? Well, the thing they don't account for is leased gold.
that throws a wrench into this complex formula.
Problem then becomes is if the gold that's being leased ended up in China, well, that's never coming back. And that means that the leases have come from the Western central banks, and what the Western central banks are reporting as their gold holdings is not in fact accurate, since they've got IOUs for the leases instead of physical bullion.
You pointed out the implications haven't really been felt yet. I mean, it's almost like there's been a Category 10 or an earthquake. The reverberations have not yet really traveled.
It's not just the SDR. Like, the issue, there's been several kind of moves by the Chinese, and the intent is to eliminate the kind of the privilege the U.S. has had as the world's reserve currency. So, for example, and unless you connect all these dots, the media is hardly reporting on them individually, let alone in total. So China has signed 26 currency swap agreements with different countries. So in the past, when China and, say, the other trading partner settled trade imbalances, they settled in U.S. dollars. So under these swap agreements, they will settle in their own currency, whether it's the yuan or whatever it's the countries involved. So there's 28. So it's almost all the major countries in the world have already signed this deal. So the U.S. dollar is no longer used for those trade settlements. They've created an Asian infrastructure investment bank that is an alternative to the IMF in terms of providing loans to BRIC countries. In Canada, they've set up a yuan currency exchange hub with the ICBC Bank of China, which is the largest bank in China. They've already developed and implemented an alternative to the SWIFT system, which is what's used to transfer currencies internationally. And Russia is in the process of developing their own version as well. And then there's Chinese acceptance. Now, the last thing that's going to have a direct impact on the gold price is that the Shanghai gold fix is to be implemented in the spring of 2016. Now, this is going to be a direct competitor to the COMEX, but it is going to be for physical only. And there's five banks from the LBMA group and 15 banks from China that are going to be setting the fix. So it'll be very unlikely that there's any playing around happen there. Secondly, because it's physical only, the issue will be is if on the COMEX you get these naked short sales that we've had over the past 3 years, then they're instantly going to be arbitraged in Shanghai. And it'll become very unprofitable to do that. So that will stop this intervention on the COMEX, which is one of the main depressors of the gold price.
Of course, we've also seen quite an interesting development with the Shanghai Gold Exchange, in that there is such an interesting offtake there that the exchange actually performs as a precious metals exchange should. It actually delivers.
It's a physical, yeah. You can only deal in physical. Where here, you've got, you know, COMEX inventories are at an all-time low. There's something like 300 ounces of paper gold to every 1 ounce of physical. And that's like a catastrophe waiting to happen.
You touched on the equities markets, the mainline media's focus, but then there's also a market that's three times as large. Of course, that's debt. We've watched high-yield bond market implode as yields soar, and, of course, with the Fed threatening another at least 100 basis points on the upside likely in 2016, perhaps even a bit more, according to the Fed funds futures rates, it doesn't bode well for debt. And debt seems to have been the engine, but a primary component to this 6 or 7 year run in equities, because inexpensive debt allows corporate treasurers and CFOs to buy back their shares on the open market. And of course, this increases demand and boosts the share price. But with debt becoming more and more expensive and difficult to procure, that might actually not be just what people need need to hear. Do you worry at all that we might see a deflationary episode, or at least disinflationary period, that takes everything down with it, just as we've seen crude oil implode and stocks and maybe even bonds?
First of all, I don't worry about it because I'm, you know, primarily in invested in gold. And what people don't realize is that gold performs better in an actual deflation than an inflation. And there's a very in-depth study by a fellow called Jastrom that looked at that over 300 years. And it sounds counterintuitive, like how can gold perform? But you measure gold in terms of purchasing power. So, for example, what happens in a deflation? Let's say real estate goes down 70% and gold goes down 25%. Well, what that means is the purchasing power of your gold relative to real estate is you can buy more real estate with your ounces. Doesn't matter what the dollar price is. And so both of them can go down in dollar terms in a deflation, but in purchasing power terms, gold goes up.
Exactly. So you're looking at nearly a threefold, not quite a threefold, improvement in your overall purchasing power for your household.
That's where the important difference is. Now, in terms of a deflation, the true definition of inflation or deflation is an increase or a contraction in money supply. So obviously we've had an increase in money supply through the Fed. And when markets implode, when debt gets default, and at this point we're looking at sovereign debt default possibility, those are all deflationary. But then what we have to look at is we go back to Bernanke's speech where he talked about there will be no deflation because the Fed can avoid it. They will, if it takes throwing money out of helicopters, then they'll do that. So the problem is that when they get a risk of deflation, they get nervous, they're going to print more money like we've never seen to avoid and to counteract the deflation. And that's when you get inflation and subsequently hyperinflation.
And I know that our listeners are going to appreciate that. And I'm actually going to make sure we write this up with your interview because I want everyone to really mull that over and digest the significance of it. Because we have guests on the show who like to point out that during the Great Depression, you know, gold lost some value. Your point that, you know what, that's okay because everything lost much more.
See, what you've got to always measure is you take and measure things in ounces. How many ounces did it take to buy a house, a car, the Dow, whatever? So that's where it comes down. It doesn't matter what the price of gold is in a paper currency that's fluctuating all over the place. It's how many ounces does it take to buy a house? How many ounces does it take to invest in the Dow? That's when you get the true measure of it.
That requires some gray matter. It's a little bit more than a cursory overview or a 30-second soundbite. You know, you talk about your lack of concern really about deflation because, you know, it really doesn't make sense. As you say, we look at the classical definition, the Keynesian perspective on deflation, and, well, come on. We've seen this massive monetary printing. It's not stopping. It's actually accelerating in Europe and in many parts of Asia. In the United States, we claim that we're not. There's some big question marks there as well.
There's a difference, too, is... We would have deflation in financial assets, debt instruments, equity instruments. We can have, that's what we're having right now, okay? But in terms of inflation and what people think of inflation, the stuff you have to buy at the grocery store to heat your home, to, you know, pay your medical bills, to pay your taxes, that's going to be still rising. So what we're going to have is an anomaly in that we've got deflation in financial assets. Now, they never called that inflation when those financial assets were rising. But right now, what we'll have is deflation because when decline, money effectively vaporizes and disappears. So, but at the same time, the true cost of living, you're probably aware of John Williams' shadow stats, we're running at about 8%. And you know, not what government concocted CPI is. So we've got a problem where we've got the the real cost of living in terms of stuff we have to buy day to day is going to be going up, and on the other hand, financial assets are going to be imploding.
There are interesting GDP numbers. When they adjust the gross domestic product by the true inflation rate that you've discussed, we have been in a full-scale recession since the year 2000, a 16-year recession. And I can say, and maybe I'm just an anomaly here, I've felt that just judging by friends, colleagues, coworkers, there was a title change in the year 2000, and we just haven't gotten back on track, unless you're one of the one-tenth of one-tenth of 1%. For the typical middle-class and working-class individual, recession has just become a way of life.
That's confirmed by some other factors, is that when we look at the participation rate, which is now in the same place it was in 1978, and it's at like 62. The thing is, that means the balance, 38%, aren't working. Mention the food stamps, the increase in the food stamps. So if the economy is doing well, then people are coming off food stamps and the participation rate is rising, not falling.
You're echoing the sentiments of Dr. Burton Malkiel at Princeton, who brought up the exact same points you have. The participation rate is abysmal. It's emblematic of a highly ill economy. Unfortunately, there's not a quick panacea that our officials are likely to, implement.
Because since before 2000, we've been exporting jobs and manufacturing in the U.S. and Canada has all been declining and being exported around the world. And new jobs haven't been taking place, nor is there enough demand. Like there's demand for high technology jobs, but in total there's not very many of them, and the people that are trying to find employees can't find them. So you've got anomalies there. The only place where they're growing, you can't find the people, and so on. So you've got a big transitional problem to overcome, just in terms of the way it's structured. If ultimately that the price of oil rises again, which it inevitably will, and the transportation costs get too high, and U.S. multinationals start bringing manufacturing home, they'll bring it home but implement with robots, and there won't be any, people working.
Another favorite on our show, Dr. Stephen Lieb from New York. We really see eye to eye on this idea that we've got to stop complaining and whining about how we've exported a 500,000 high-paying industrial jobs per year and really accept the fact that we've entered a new world. And then this idea of robotics is fascinating, because up to 50% of the current jobs, 2016, 2015, that we see today will be replaced within the next decade or sooner by robotics. And here's a quick example. Why do you need 12 people to make that burger and package those French fries when it can very easily, remotely, you can swipe your card at the drive-thru, those French fries and a sandwich, perfectly made, no human hairs, unadulterated by mankind, in a fraction of the time?
Breaks, no vacations, no time off, 24/7. That's going to be a huge transitional problem.
I think you brought up another quandary that we're facing, this huge amount of debt. We started to go down this route, and I'd like to finish up with it. And, we're looking at our five or six major money center banks here in North America who have taken on a little extra debt. According to some of the figures, we're looking at roughly $250 to $300 trillion in notional derivative. These numbers start to numb one's mind. When you talk about these numbers, $300 trillion, the national gross domestic product for a year, can this be sustained? And if, even one domino starts to fall in the financial sector, what type of cascade effect might that have?
That's been the problem, and we didn't learn anything in 2008. It's now everything has gotten worse since 2008, not better. And no lessons have been learned, and we're going to do the same thing, but it'll be times 10 this time around. That's the problem. And we've got, we saw a taste in terms of what happens in an implosion in Cyprus and Greece. So that was like the canary in the coal mine. So that's now happening in countries all over the world. South America is a giant disaster. Most of the former tax haven islands in the Caribbean are economically like Greece or Cyprus, and it's filtering all over the world in terms of the commodity producer countries are all having a tough time, and in most cases the debt is denominated in U.S. dollars, which have risen. So we're going to have multiple sovereign debt defaults, and that could very well be cascading. When you get to the U.S., the thing is, when you add up all the current cash debt and the unfunded liabilities, it comes out to about $1 million per taxpayer.
That's about four times what we typically read in the blogosphere. You've got an interesting metric here. Could you maybe break it down for our listeners?
There's, like, if we take roughly $18 trillion of cash debt, but when we talk about unfunded liabilities, that's another $122. If your readers go to the U.S. debt clock, it's interactive and running all the time, and it'll show you all the components of the debt and what it translates to per person, per taxpayer, per household. All that's on the U.S. debt clock website.
Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, a regular here from Boston University, underscored and highlighted just what you pointed out. In fact, that's, you might say, one of his biggest points, although he's been giving us great tips for Social Security and disability lately. The INFORM Act, big proponent there. He has something like 17 Nobel laureates who have signed, and anyone listening to our voice can. But I think that he really brings home everything you've just brought up. When the true tally, as you say, unfunded liabilities, this is just an enormous sum. I will say that you're the first to bring up roughly a million dollars per person.
Per taxpayer, because only about 50% of the people are taxpayers.
What if one were to become financially independent?
I'm not sure, because this is already, for instance, in the U.S., the Social Security system is somewhat different than Canada. When wages are deducted and the money is paid into Social Security, that goes into the general government pot. So they pay out Social Security from that and spend whatever's left over. So it's they've been in a position where they've been spending the excess instead of investing it. In Canada, when we take our Canada Pension Plan contributions, those are invested. We can talk about whether they're the best investments, but they're at least invested. They're not simply purchasing government T-bills with them. And where you get the thing is, the way the U.S. does their financial statements is not according to generally accepted accounting principles, because if a public corporation has unfunded pension liabilities, that shows up in terms of their annual income statement. So if you did that in the U.S., the annual deficit would be something in the order of $5 to $6 trillion instead of what they're proposing as a deficit. That's the cash deficit, not the accrued deficit in terms of the current year's amount. So when you look at an economy, a $5 to $6 trillion deficit is almost half of the entire GDP.
We had that wake up moment. We've had several rehypothecates. We've even had MF Global, which seems is off everybody's radar screen today. The writing is on the wall. We've had the warning shot across the bow. We've got to start thinking in terms of no liens against your investments. When I start to think about how stocks, who owns the stocks? Is it some corporation somewhere? Is it a holding company? Is it the Federal Reserve?
That's a whole other long discussion, because whether it's client margin accounts or most mutual funds and so on, the brokers in many cases are the authorized participants to ETFs, and whether they're equities or gold are lent to an ETF. So then they're shorted, and through the shorting process, again, rehypothecated and so on. So you have multiple claims on the same assets. So that this whole ETF Ponzi scheme is one day going to end very, very badly.
And we've already seen signs of the unraveling there with the investigations by policymakers and authorities starting to recognize that these rollover fees and related expenses and expense ratios are exorbitant. It's just smoke and mirrors. Who really owns what? And there's another interesting aspect here. If you look at the fine print on, for instance, StreetTracks, I think that's the largest, at least North American gold ETF, at least it was at one point. Only folks with investments of roughly, I think it's $1 million, it might be $100,000, but it's a huge sum, have any potential leverage getting their funds, you know, any type of delivery of gold. And even that is questionable.
You'd have to be, if you're a very large investor, you still couldn't redeem. You'd have to do it through an authorized participant. And it's only the authorized participants that have signed agreements and get the ability to contribute baskets or redeem them. So presumably if they redeemed a basket on behalf of a very large investor, you could get delivery of that gold. But that's the only way I know of getting physical bullion, you know, out of the ETF. The main concern is that the bullion that's sitting in the ETF has been borrowed ultimately from the central banks and is just parked there.
Yeah, how many times has that been leased and rehypothecated itself?
Technically, when a central bank leases gold, you know, in a bizarre way, the gold remains the property of the central bank, just like with any other lease. The lessee can sell the gold, and he just promises to return equal bars.
Naked shorting. How interesting.
An anomaly. So the thing is that if the ownership is still at the central bank, at the ETF, and something goes wrong with the authorized participant, the central banks are going to ask for their gold back or demand their gold back.
I like how you put that, ask for their gold back, at gunpoint. Right?
Lawyers will get rich. That's the growth opportunity.
Since obviously there appears to be some exciting opportunity developing, markets can't stay depressed forever. With all this concern about whether or not you own an ETF, all the legislation that's being written under the fine print, we just don't know whether we own it or who owns it and what's going on. Wouldn't it be nice to have some physical gold? So tell us a bit about bullion. Give us an idea of opportunities for every level investor, the novice, the neophyte, all the way to the expert investor.
Yeah, I guess the starting point for the small investors are silver bullion coins, and whether they're, you know, this is, you know, U.S. gold eagles or Canadian maples, that kind of thing. The thing to do is just buy the simple bullion coins and not numismatics or even semi-numismatics, just pure bullion coins. That's the easiest place to start. Past that, like in we have our two mutual funds, which are primarily for Canadian retail registered retirement savings account, where as money comes in, we just, you know, buy bullion as required. And then for large accredited investors, we have a program where we sell them the actual, you know, large LBMA bars. And we provide storage either with the Bank of Nova Scotia or through Brinks all over the world. We have storage facilities with Brinks in Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, Dubai, Switzerland, Panama. So we arrange that for our investors that buy the physical bullion, and we have a, you know, variety of choices. So that for U.S. investors, it would be the bullion that would make the most sense. The way to do it would be to buy it and store it with Brinks and, you know, wherever you choose around the world.
Let's talk a bit about $10,000 gold. This is your magnum opus. I have at least one or two copies here already, so we appreciate that. And it's just must-read material for all of our listeners, all of whom are aficionados. So please tell us a bit more. I know that this is a labor of love. I bet you wouldn't recommend writing, going through the process for most people, time-consuming, challenging endeavor. But tell us more about $10,000 gold, please.
That was the first book in. Like you say, it took a long time to write, 3 years, because I tried to make it so it's digestible to everybody. And it's a very complicated subject overall. So I've tried to simplified, and I've received a lot of compliments that people were able to understand, you know, what I was saying in the book. I have been writing a sequel to it, which we hope to bring out later this year, which will update things. And really, the update that the past at $10,000 gold has actually improved. The conditions that I talk about in the $10,000 gold book have actually gotten worse, and the debt has gotten higher, and so on. So that premise of $10,000 gold still exists very much. Since I've written the book, there's many observers have come up with even higher predictions than $10,000 an ounce. Print enough money, you could reach them.
Exactly. And so there's really nothing to stop a one-to-one ratio on gold and the Dow. We've just seen it so many times. I don't know that specifically, maybe not one-to-one, but in the general vicinity, as we look back over the decades and over the past 100 years.
We're very close to one-to-one in 1980.
This game may be only in the early innings. I mean, this is going to be quite a fascinating time. And we certainly hope that everybody listening to our voices today, you know, starts to take measures, make contingencies. It never hurts to have a safety net. And I can't think of a better safety net than bullion. Nick Barashev, oh, wow, are we going to look forward to this new tome, hopefully in 2016. And those who haven't already, you've got to pick up a copy of $10,000 Gold. You can do it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookshop. Nick Barashev, that's BMG Group. You know, inform your neighbors, family, friends. Let's not drop the ball. Let's stay on top of this. If any parting comments today?
Like I said in the Empire Club speeches, if you're invested in equities, I think it's time to heavily rebalance and move those assets, or you're going to, you know, face a very painful 2016.
I'll bet there's probably a video up of the Empire Club speech.
Yeah, it's on YouTube, yeah.
We'll embed the video then, and we'll make sure that's embedded up on Goldseek. What a pleasure. I hope that you'll, you know, drop by a bit more frequently, and we're going to hear more from you in 2016.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of Goldseek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
Goldseek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Houston, we have a problem. Washington, we have a problem. Name your city because wherever you live, we have a problem. Even if, especially if, your city, your business, your profession, your lifestyle per se has not yet officially been acknowledged as having problems. Those problems, those structural anomalies in the building blocks of your financial future are there. And even if you've done a tremendous job in planning and preparing for yourself and your family, the anticipated fallout from a massive financial reset will have ramifications that will shake you to the core, of whatever level of preparedness you have attained. No matter where you are at, you must continue to analyze, critically analyze the rapid influx of new ideas and analyses thrust upon you each and every day. The New Year market sell-off has produced two distinct schools of thought that you will see represented in a combination of alternative and mainstream media analysts. Alternative analysts tend to be fiercely independent, often disagreeing with each other on many layers of an argument. They are much like overlapping circles. The circles overlap and have a commonality in the middle, with a variety of unique outlying perspectives that create niche opinions around a central theme. Mainstream media tends to consist of overlapping circles that have converged into a uniform or managed message that is broadcast to the masses for global consumption. Any unique outlying perspectives where the circles do not overlap, what I call acceptable parameters of debate, are managed and massaged for an official narrative. The current official narrative during this continual sell-off in the stock market is urging investors to stay the course and keep their money in the market for the long term. I don't see any headlines suggesting people convert any gains from this highly leveraged stock market into cash, never mind undervalued physical gold and silver. The mainstream pundits are leading with headlines that proclaim the bear market in stocks will be over before you know it. Others say much of the damage has already happened. If you believe that, do you have your own stop-loss number on the Dow? In other words, is there a certain level at which you will sell your portfolio, go into cash and take a wait-and-see approach? It may be a question worth considering, especially when you look at how many of the alternative media analysts are interpreting the market at the moment. From an overlapping circle perspective, those circles are converging for the worst, with many calling for the market to drop by up to half or more to align itself with reality. It is an ugly financial reality that is being described. Very few saw the 2008 collapse coming. The injection of liquidity from the dot-com bubble burst, the fallout from 9/11, and the subsequent housing pump-and-dump ran its course during the early 2000s and culminated in 2008. That crisis never really ended. It's had a tourniquet applied to the wound. The patient is still alive, but the market is telling us their arm may need to be amputated. It's a real mess. And unlike 2008, lots of analysts are warning us with specifics on what to do. But I'm afraid there is still a tremendous amount of denial that exists and remains, even from those who vividly remember the trauma of 2008 and 2009. Now is not the time to tune out uncomfortable messages. If you have recovered somewhat or completely, or were fortunate enough not to have been impacted by 2008, Now is not the time to wait until everyone is headed for the exits, because the off-ramps are small, and there are too many vehicles. A lesson that will once again be painfully well learned by many people who may never have another opportunity to recover if the markets reach the full negative potential that many expect yet this year. Anticipate the future and act on it in advance. Chris, David Morgan has invited me to speak at his Las Vegas Solutions Conference on February 22nd, along with Chris Martinson, Greg Mannarino, and a team of experts. Details are at conquerchange.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at conquerchange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.